This is a free off the ball podcast. For access to the best in sporting analysis from the likes of Brian O'Driscoll, Andy Dunn, Kevin Kilbane, Dion Fanning, Tommy Walsh, Darren O'Sullivan and lots more, become an Off the Ball member today.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball, GAA.
Now between them, Limerick's Mick Mackey and Cork's Christy Ring won 11 All-Ireland senior hurling titles on the field of play over a 20-year spell from 1934 to 1954. The two men, legends of the game, and Arthur James O'Dea, a senior producer here at Off the Ball, has brought legend to the page with his excellent new book that I'm going to have in my hand here. I'm going to show it to the anybody tuning in on our digital channels, the book Mackey and Ring. And Arthur's going to talk about it over the next hour. How are you doing, Arthur? Very good afternoon to you.
Flying. How are you?
I'm great, Arthur. I really enjoyed reading this excellent book.
Thank you.
Which I finished this morning. You spotted a marker for this. I would have never thought of a book like this, Mackey and Ring. Why did you decide to write about these two legends?
It's a great question. And it's an interesting about spotting a market. I don't know what you think. In terms of books, in terms of documentaries, in terms of any sort of, I suppose, creative activity around GA history, I just don't think we have enough of it. Like, in general, like, there probably aren't enough books. There aren't.
It might be
anything
done locally. You'd have so in Kerry football, you'd have maybe a local journalist or historians in the county might do something about a local, but on a national level, maybe not, no.
Yeah, and there's some standout, like Mick Foley's great book about the 82 All-Ireland.
Kings of September.
Yeah, amazing book. And there are examples
House
out there.
House of Payne, Keith Duggan on Mayo.
Absolutely. And Henry Martin, who's a Limerick man, wrote a great book about Limerick and Mackey. And
Limited Heartbreak.
Tim Horgan wrote a great book about Ring. But it's fairly sparse, really, given how prominent these figures, not just Mackey and Ring, are in our lives.
Like,
because we treat them as big as any footballer or whatever, rugby player or whatever else. They're as prominent in our lives, but there just isn't the same sort of I suppose literature, whatever else, built around them. So it, for me, it seemed very obvious once I started thinking about it. It was like, which are these two lads? There's a wealth of information there to probe.
Who, for people of a certain age, you don't really are not maybe connected to who Mick Mackey and Christy Ring were. Who was Mick Mackey?
So Mick Mackey was, in effect, the star hurler, the biggest star, we can say, whatever you want to kind of go on about, best player, whatever, the biggest star from a kind of breakthrough Limerick team in the 30s and 40s that won three All-Irelands, numerous Munster titles, played on numerous Railway Cup teams. He was the standout figure from that era. And then Christy Ring comes from the 40s on right up into the 60s. I mean, he was unquestionably the best player on a number of different Cork teams that, as you said, won eight All-Irelands, which, of course, in 54 was the record. So he set that record. He sort of redefined, I suppose, what success even was, could be conceived of in hurling, in Gaelic games. So that was kind of, then they ran one generation into another, with a little bit of crossover.
It was really only the Kilkenny hurlers of recent times that surpassed Ring's eight with Shefflin, Tommy Welch, these types of players.
Absolutely.
Getting past that.
Shefflin's probably the modern sort of equivalent, I'd say, in terms of the centrality that he had in that team.
Yes.
That's kind of the only thing, I suppose, in a modern era we could probably equate it to. I don't think there were similar players or similar whatever else, but yeah, in terms of significance.
We all even know how hurling's changed over the last 20 years, 30 years. Yeah. When like the scores in the game now, the speed of the game, you probably need about 30 points to win a match now. What was hurling like when you were doing the research for this book back then? I mean, it seemed to be, first of all, I didn't really twig this actually until I read the book, that the game was only 60 minutes until 1969.
Yeah. And then I think it went up to 80 for a bit.
Yeah,
I remember
from
73
70 to 75, it was 80 minutes, and then it went back to 70.
Yeah, which seems, in I know it's what we have, so I think, but that does seem perfect. 35-35 seems lovely. What was the game like? Well, definitely there was a greater occurrence of goals, without any shadow of a doubt. So very rarely you'd see points climbing up into the teens.
Yeah.
So it was a considerably lower scoring game in terms of scores taken, even though the tallies might go up because the goals obviously still counted for three. But hard, I suppose. You know, there wasn't substitutes as such for most of it. So it was a hard thing where you continue, and I suppose if someone's hurt, they'll continue. But that'll obviously bring down the level a little bit and whatever else. But I don't think the hardiness can be undersold in what it was. You're required to be a certain sort of toughness. And I suppose that's where players like Mackie and Ring in this instance then break above the parapet and become noticed, because they do have tremendous skill to go with that. But like, even the image there in the front, like, you see, like, it's Christy Ring in a sling. You know, his wrist has been broken in two places. It's like, that's kind of what you're dealing with. And that's not a one-off freak accident. That's a day's going up against Tipperary full back line and then finally, I suppose, getting the better of him in one way.
So, Asian 88 was the Asian 87 hurling final, which was the first one the GA found in 1984 in Thurles. And Mick Mackey and Christy Ring were almost children of the revolution, to quote Mark Bolan. So, 1912 was when Mick Mackey was born, he was born later that year. So, just under 4 years of the Easter Rising. And then Christy Ring was born in the War of Independence. Yeah. So, the formative years were in a very much a change in Ireland at the time.
Oh, massively, massively. And I think, particularly with Mackey, but I suppose by virtue of the fact he comes first chronologically in this, a lot of things start when he starts, but there was a great bit of serendipity where he starts hurling intercounty right at the start of the 1930s, which you think then is, you're approaching almost the 10-year anniversary of the War of Independence, Civil War being concluded. So there's a relative sort of stasis in the country, you know, and you'll have that kind of election that brings Éamon de Valera back into power later, I think. So things had, you know, who obviously lost the War of Independence, and things had become stabilised, which I suppose then allowed people want to enjoy themselves and wanted to, they had more free time. There was a degree of the society had calmed itself down, so you're kind of looking for other avenues of interest. And that leads to basically, by the time Mackie's coming along, that you have significantly higher numbers going to games than you never have had before. So, I mean, we only just celebrated, say, the first anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the first radio broadcast of a GAA game from Croke Park.
1926, yeah.
Yeah. So, right across the board in newspapers and radio, it had become a multimedia thing, I suppose, in real terms. And the interest was pushed so far up that you've tens of thousands all of a sudden going to games. And right across the 1930s, all the All-Ireland finals almost every year seemed to be a new record. More people going and going and going. And I suppose from Mackie's point of view, first to be, maybe, you know, if he'd been born 20 years earlier, maybe he'd have been a great star in the 1910s, like his father was.
Tyler Mackie was his name.
But the fact it was just the right place, right time, it's almost like the sort of thing where if you were fortunate enough to become, I guess, a footballing star at the start of the Premier League, that type of thing where it, like, You just, like Eric Cantona, it shoots you into a different sort of thing, because just more people are seeing, more people are talking about it. And that was, I suppose, their great fortune, and it carried naturally on to Ring. But as you're saying, born in kind of a period of turmoil, they just found that sweet spot to latch on to when they came of age. They were ready for it. It was ready for stars like that to come and be rightly acclaimed.
And also with Ireland becoming an independent nation, Free State, and then eventually a republic in 1949, but ultimately becoming a free state from the 20s onwards, the GA was very much identified with the New Ireland. So it was embraced by Éamon de Valera and the Irish Press newspaper, newspaper. And then you have the confluence events. You have, as you say, matches then on the radio, and then newspaper columns, the Limerick Leader, obviously, and then... So it was just ripe conditions for, it's almost like the establishment wanted this sport to succeed, hurling. Well, there's the mythology, the Cú Chulainn stuff, and these were our sports. Mm-hmm. Croke Park, you've Cork Athletic Grounds, you've the Gaelic Grounds. And when two stars come along, everything just fits into place.
And it's a great point you make about a paper like the Irish Press. I think that came in in 31, and it basically launched, I think I'm almost right in the year. It was a car. It launched on the day of, or in the bit right around the 1931 All-Ireland Hurling Final between Cork and Kilkenny. And that so happened to go to three games. Now, they were spread out over, it wasn't week to week to week. It was spread over, I think it finished up in October, some stage in early November. But there's an amazing thing where they made a big play with this, and they made a big play about photography, which was obviously still quite nascent, but was getting better. And there's an amazing thing in, I think, the third before or after the third, it was when after the third and decisive final, where the photo they put on the front of the paper was a photo of the crowd. So when you think about it, like, even it wasn't from the players, it wasn't of the winning team, it wasn't of anything like that, it was of the crowd. And it was such an incredible sort of evocative way, I suppose, of going to readers, like, you know, where else would you rather be? And you think about even the GA slogans now, they still kind of go to things like, what's their thing? It's like, it's nothing beats being there.
Where we all belong.
Yeah, exactly. Where we all belong. And it's just that, it's an amazing thing that by that stage, that was already being tapped into by the Turks. They realised and they locked onto it. And to be fair, all the papers locked onto it. The Irish Press just happened to come along then. So there's a greater kind of feeling with it. But they were all, it became so massive. And you'd have this amazing thing all the time when you're going through the archive on like the Examiner. I think it was on like page 3, the Cork Examiner then. So the first overlay, and you'd have a big laydown of all different pictures, just a full thing of pictures. And like some were sport, some were whatever else was going on. But it just, there was a real emphasis, I suppose, on showing you what was happening. And it obviously was incredibly effective because, again, the numbers just keep rising, staggering numbers. Like when Tyler Mackey played in the All-Ireland final in 1910.
Mixed dad
for Limerick. There was approximately 10,000 there. Now, who knows what the exact number, but about 10,000. That's what it was gauged at, with Limerick-Wexford. And by the time Mackey plays his first final in 33, so whatever, 23 years later, and onwards, it's going from 30 to 40,000 up and up and up through that, sneaking up until it gets up to, I suppose, with she's rings last one.
I have it here, 84,856. More than is there now.
Yeah.
More than you have now for an All-Ireland final because it's capped at 82,300.
And this is like happening in real time. Like it's not like we're talking about like years and years apart. It's just, it keeps on growing. In whatever way, it was extremely effective. But it was undoubtedly, I suppose, the stars that played a role in bringing people out as well.
So Mackey, it seems from reading the book, Arthur, that he was a very physically strong player. He played centre forward. His brother John played in the team as well for Limerick. Limerick hadn't had that much success. They won, I think, 1897, 1918, 1921. They hadn't that much. They hadn't that much success.
No,
compared to say Cork or Kilkenny or. So therefore, when he came through. They won 4 Munster titles in a row. We had the John Kiley team winning, I believe, 6 in a row.
6, yes.
So 4 in a row, and then Mick Mackey was a big part of that. Why was Mick Mackey the standout player? What did he have in his hurling armoury, as it were?
As you said, like, so sturdy. I mean, extremely strong. He wasn't necessarily that tall. I suppose just shy of 6 foot, but strong, broad, and I suppose tremendous skill. I mean, they say that he inherited it from his father, but that sort of famous thing that he had at the time was an ability, I suppose, to hold the ball on the hurl and charge. And I suppose at that stage, you didn't necessarily need to go round. You could go through whoever was in front of you. You weren't going to get pulled back for that. But an additional thing, I suppose, it's what is so interesting about all these things is brother John, I think it was 13 months younger than him or so, thereabouts, but they kind of broke through in tandem. And I think what really seemed to help, because there was a strong, Ahan was obviously their club, who were the dominant club in Limerick hurling at the time.
Castleconnell area.
Exactly. And they were the strong club at the time. And they obviously had plenty of representation on the Limerick team. And it is, I think it's safe to assume as well that that probably helped. This team had a great kind of feel for each other. And they had a great ability to, I suppose it probably in some sort of camaraderie or whatever else, but a great ability to interweave with one another, and that effectiveness undoubtedly helped him. It can't but for whatever reason, it's really hard to pin down why individuals stand out. He obviously was a high scorer, he was everything else, but like, I think you go back, like John Mackey was considered no less a hurler than his brother, but for whatever reason, maybe it's down to things, aesthetic things as well. Like he looked the part, he looked a star from the get-go. Whether that was self-styled or was just how he tended to present himself, he just looked it. He looked the part.
He looks, when you see that photo of him with the cup, I think it's 1940 with the Liam McCarthy Cup. He looks the part, doesn't he?
Yeah, great hair, dark hair, and kind of. I'd always have the shirt a little bit kind of open. You a little bit of chest on show, like clinging to him, like very. He just again, it's very hard. You don't know you don't want to afford it to him if that wasn't his plan, but it seems unlikely that he was aware, I suppose, of his centrality, and he was happy to present himself as such.
So he won 3 All-Irelands, 1934, 36 and 40, the last two as captain, Mick Mackey for Limerick. Ahan is funny because the Morrissey's from Ahan.
Yeah.
Dan Morrissey, Tom Morrissey, Ollie Moran in recent years. It's interesting, the thread of a club over, say, 100 years. And then you've got Cloyne, where Christy Ring was from, where Donal O'Cusack,
Yeah.
Dermot the Rock O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
And Christy Ring was born, what, 1920, a bit after Mick Mackey, and was a very good miner. So yeah. it seemed from an early age that Christy Ring was spotted as somebody that was going to make it at the big time.
I think anyone who didn't seem to spot it originally wasn't long coming to realization, like that this guy was like, it's incredible. It's an uncomfortable analogy because it doesn't work in terms of Messi versus Ronaldo. It's not that type of dynamic with Mackie, but Ring's likeness to Messi in terms of just how he seemed to operate is oddly kind of aligned. It was immediate, you know, and then you don't know. Then it's like we have now, like when Clifford was coming through, you're like, what is this guy's ceiling? It's like, not too sure, but like it is clear from the get go that he was incredibly special. And his first 5 years in Cork, he won four All-Irelands. He won four in a row. And it didn't necessarily cut through in the exact same way because it was during the war, World War II. So attendances were quite low at some of those games.
Yes.
But then, I mean, by that stage, his reputation was assured and it was kind of glossing it. It was for the next...
We talk about Mackie there and the physicality. What was it, Ring? Was it just... there was a line in the book, wrists.
Yeah.
The wrists.
Well, there was an amazing thing, and I'll not forget the names of who was involved, but there was definitely some Cork minor match and he must have been warming up or something beforehand. And maybe it was coming before a senior match that Kilkenny were involved in. And it was someone who had been another teammate on the team had heard this senior Kilkenny fella come over to Ring and comment and effectively, I've never seen wrists like yours. And he was only a boy at the stage, like literally a boy playing minor hurling for Cork. But that seemed to be it. I mean, again, an incredible toughness, but not the same physicality maybe that he could dominate people in that sense like Mackie could. But just an incredible intelligence and like dogged determination. I don't think that can be overstressed as well. In Val Dorgan's kind of great book, The Memoir About Him, he obviously had a good personal relationship with Ring, so really got to dig into some things. And there's an amazing scene where he's talking to him after Ring had retired. And I think he probes that. He probes the idea of what made you different. And Ring has something like, you know, they were at this bar and he was, if the ball was the other side of that bar and this was full and everyone had to go for it, I'd be the first one there, even if I had to claw and whatever my way there to get it. So I think there was an odd, it's that odd kind of beautiful balance where someone's incredibly skillful, but also probably has the work ethic and determination of a far less skillful player, which is like, that's pair them together and there's no stopping you.
It's interesting from reading the book that this was a new Ireland, a Catholic Ireland, I would say, very much dominated by the church. And it seems that the major expressions of Christy Ring and Mick Mackey were done through their hurling. They were seen maybe as unassuming gentlemen off the pitch and they didn't carry a loudness off the pitch that they might have seen in their hurling exploits because... they just had ordinary jobs. They were ordinary folk. I mean, a lot of Gaelic stars today have the same, but the marketing that they did was through their hurling almost.
Yeah, they weren't particularly gregarious, particularly Ring. I mean, again, he was, I think, notably shy and not even notably shy maybe in a sense, but even very, it would take an awful lot for him to trust you. And he didn't necessarily have that outwardness that would kind of open you up to strangers and meeting new people and whatever else. Mackie, it's a little bit harder to kind of harder to pair back because it was an interesting thing. It's an interesting detail when he finished, and he lived in Clare. He lived by the power station at ESB where he worked, Arna Crusha. So that's where he ended up living. He didn't end up living in Limerick at all. And once he finished, all the cups, all the whatever else went away. They were put away under the bed. Like you would walk into the house and you wouldn't know that he'd done all he'd done. So I don't know, is that there's a certain humility with it, but neither of them were particularly gregarious, outgoing, look at me kind of guys. But again, that's until you get on the pitch where it's that kind of thing. And I suppose that's a kind of common enough thing. Like I was kind of, you're kind of wondering about it. And it's not to bring everything back to him, but he's the biggest star we have now. But that, you know, if David Clifford walked down O'Connell Street or Grafton Street, people would recognise him. Some people might recognise him, whatever else. And maybe it's better to say with a hurler, I suppose. But they didn't have a showiness, I think, in real life, in day-to-day life, that one can tell by any stretch of the imagination.
We're talking to Arthur James Adee about his new book, Mackie and Ring, about two hurling legends. We're into 5 minutes of stoppage time at Anfield. Liverpool 2, Nottingham Forest 2 in the Premier League. Can either team get a winner, or are Liverpool heading for their second 2-2 draw of the new Premier League season? We also have, remember, Championship games. Derby 0, Swansea 2, Middlesbrough 3, West Brom 1, and Wolves 4 now, Stoke 1. All these matches approaching a conclusion. We talked about the Irish press and that, but even the local papers. Why, in the book, all these columnists had pseudonyms, yeah, in the local papers. Did you find out why?
It's funny, we had the launch last night in O'Mahony's bookshop in Limerick, and we got talking about this. And I can't figure it out. I don't know. And maybe someone out there does know. I don't know. Like, maybe it was just an affectation that kind of one did it, so kind of that was the way, and you kind of went on doing it. I presume it probably happened in other areas as well that weren't sport, maybe, yeah, in different columnists, so maybe it was kind of a handover from that.
Parbury was the one was in the
Parbury computer. Was Paddy Mehigan, yeah. Again, and in another sort of way, what is funny, because Thomond was obviously the big one in Limerick, and he had his weekly Limerick Leader column. But Thomond was W.F. Lee, who was a Castleconnell man. So he obviously had a natural... Now, you wouldn't... Coming to that, reading that, you wouldn't be told that. That doesn't... That's not... He's not making that apparent, but you don't have to dig too deep to find that out. And it kind of then you put it into a different thing when you're reading. It's like, geez, yeah, he is very, very, very kind of complimentary of Mick Mackey all these times, even when other people are certainly questioning him at the start of his career. So maybe there was a degree to which the names were chosen to kind of, I suppose, afford them a degree of even the veneer of objectivity, even though, like, they all were part of clubs, they all were kind of enmeshed in their own little communities, and it must have what influenced what were in effect kind of community notes and such. But why? I don't know, and I'd love to find out.
There's not much footage. I know there was a documentary done on Ring in the book that you point to, but how did you manage to do the research for this book, Arthur? Did you have to go to the National Library? Did you have to go to the libraries of the local papers? Where did you begin? Because it seems like a mammoth task to delve into, because there's a lot of hearsay with a lot of this, but to actually find out the facts was probably a big thing to do.
So there's a lot of the National Library, and to be fair, the resources there are incredible in terms of the sort of microfilm they have, and just an awful lot of books that have kind of long since gone out of print and whatever else, but they obviously have everything, and there's amazing things you can find out through that just by kind of looking in kind of very basic terms. You'll find, geez, there's something that's written in 1938 about thing. It's like, we'll get that, we'll get a hold of that and see what's in it, and that helps inform, I suppose, the broader picture of the age. Beyond that, the biggest thing you spend the most time in is the Irish newspaper archive. It's like just constant, and that's an amazing resource. Obviously years and years, all the newspapers are somewhere, but then for them to digitise them all, and it's imperfect at times, because obviously it's not the most reliable search tool, so there's an awful lot of just going back and going, like, I know something happened roughly in May 1933, and you're going paper by paper, day by day, or every two or three days, whatever they were when they came out, and looking for it. But it's time consuming, but it's amazing, because that helps you find other stuff. Basically, you're just kind of, if you're willing to just go into it, what a great thing is, I suppose, is if say a particular match in a particular month in a year has relevance to you. But when you have to go through all the papers, invariably you always see the front page. So you're like, oh, this was happening in the world at that time. And it puts a fresh flavour on things, and it helps you, I suppose, reattach it to real life in the day rather than just taking it in isolation. So that was a massive benefit. But it was kind of, there's a look involved to it, but it's just, it was a massive benefit that.
Did you visit the areas at all, or did you speak to anybody?
Yeah.
Any grandchildren or great-grandchildren?
I spoke to Mick Mackey's daughter.
Right.
Who passed during the actual writing of it, who had an amazing detail that is very, I couldn't shore it up, so it didn't really make it in any way, because she had been ill when I was talking to her, but she made a comment that, although the two lads really didn't have any sort of interpersonal relationship at all, she said that their respective wives talked to each other on the phone, which is an amazing thing to consider. Now, it didn't, again, it was a very difficult thing to dig any further in. I didn't want to just put it in off the word of one person. But it's a very interesting thing to consider, because I suppose they would have probably met at functions and different things like that. I don't think it's necessarily linked to the two guys being as prominent as they were or whatever, like that they had that in common. I wouldn't assume that, but it's a very interesting thing to consider that there was that link there, because I guess, as I said, the two boys really didn't have... They went, I mean, obviously Mick Mackey went to Christy Ring's funeral, but like half the country did by the scene. But so they didn't really have that link otherwise. So she was amazing to talk to. And then, I mean, the other thing, there's obviously a lot. The further back you go, by the time you're going back to Mackey, you are talking, most of his contemporaries have passed on. But an amazing thing was, there was a guy from Limerick, from Clahawn. Mikey Graham was his name. And you might remember from that picture of that Justin Nelson took of Mackey and Ring from 57, that the zoomed out picture, the initial one that was cropped in the paper in the Clonmel Nationalist was the one on the front of the book. It was cropped into that degree. But with time, when it came out, it was viewed out a bit. And there was a fella on his knees looking up at them. And his name, I mean, almost, it was Jack Molyneux, who was also Clon Limerick man, used to always position himself there behind the goals. I spoke to his son, who explained all that, that that was where he loved to see the goals going in, he said. So that's where he sat. But there was another guy there as well, Mikey Graham, who was only young, ended up playing for Limerick. I think he missed out on the 73 All-Ireland through injury, but he was obviously a serious player as well. And he was there as well. So being able to talk to him, he's still going, he's great. To be able to talk to him, someone who was there, probably the only living person who was within touching distance of the whole moment, was an amazing kind of boon. It was really interesting.
I'm holding the, for anybody watching our digital channels and our live stream on YouTube, or on social media, I'm holding up the front cover of the book here, Mackey and Ring, with Mick Mackey as an umpire at the 1957 Munster semi-final when he'd retired. You can't really imagine Henry Shefflin being an umpire now, could you, at an All-Ireland final or whatever. Speaking to Christy Ring, who had a wrist injury and was going off, I believe, why did the photo have such resonance for you, and why did you make it such a central part of the book?
I think its resonance for me is it just a completely common feeling it inspired. There was an amazing little nugget from the Clonmel Nationalist. That photo came out 6 days after the game, because it was a weekly paper. It came out on Saturday, so they were sitting on it for a week. And there's an amazing detail from that December 57, a little editorial note where they've reprinted the photo again and mentioned how they'd been inundated with requests from all over Munster for copies of the picture. Now, I don't know how far the Clonmel Nationalist was spreading initially. So it obviously had gotten either through word of mouth or something else that you had this thing all of a sudden that this photo was in existence. And it had an instant acclaim for people. People wanted it. And they wanted a copy of it. And they wanted to, I suppose, think all the things through that the thing inspires. Because it inspires kind of questions. Because it's an immediate thing. You're like, who said what to whom? What, all that type of stuff. I have no idea when I first saw it, but obviously, and you'll know, growing up, I grew up obviously in a household where my father's from Limerick, and you'll know obviously with family from Clare, the same thing. You're kind of enmeshed in it in a way that you're kind of, because you're not in the place, you're just looking for as much information as you can about it. You're so keen to learn all you can. And obviously Mackey was a fixture in our house growing up. And I suppose at some early stage, the photo came into existence. But what's so funny still is that when you're contacting people, when I was contacting people for the book, saying this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm talking about, it's like, oh, it was always a case of, oh, have you seen the great picture, or you know the great, and that was the first thing everyone always said.
Right.
It was incredible. It was without fail, everyone always mentioned it. I suppose that's natural. And while the two guys do hold their own kind of individuality for sure, and Ring in Cork is bigger than anything you could place him with, his size there is enormous, but it, as far as the two guys, I don't know which way it is, that the photo is sort of indicative of the two guys when mentioned together, or it has forced the two guys to be mentioned together. But I suppose that's what I was looking to tease out. And for me, it just served as a perfect starting point, because then you can kind of go forward and backwards from there. And like, what the sad sort of thing is that that's 57. So like, they're both dead within 25 years. You know, like, to think that for a guy who's still playing Intercounty Hurling, that's not very long.
No.
So the afterwards is kind of all acclaim. Ring plays for a few more years, but like, it just served as a natural starting point. Even the caption at the time in the Clonmel Nationalist had it that, like, Mick Mackey, who'll need no introduction to our readers. Now that to me is impossibly enticing. Why a 45-year-old Mick Mackey, who's not, He's obviously so recognisable even then, not in a jersey, however many years, 10 plus years after he's finished playing, that he was of such stature that they could confidently say that to readers in a paper that wasn't in Limerick. So you're like, right, that to me, it gives you a scale of the thing that these guys were enormous. And I think there's an interesting thing where even to think, and maybe it's the modern biases when you're looking back, like, you'd have always assumed in the 50s or whatever that they would have been known by name, but I found it captivating that they'd have been known by face. There's something in that where you're going back. It's like these guys, you just don't assume because we've no footage.
And before helmets as well.
Yeah, but you forget about the photography element of it, that these guys were known to be seen. That to me was a very interesting thing, because that's whatever about your name kind of granting you a degree of fame. If your face is known like that, that does change your life, whatever way, shape or form you put in it, because you can't obviously, you go out and you're known. And that's an interesting thing to have to contend with when, as you're saying, like in a world where even now GAA stars have to kind of operate with a degree of humility. I mean, 70, 80 years ago, like, God almighty, God forbid you got too big for your boots. Like,
yeah. When you were doing your research, when you were going through the things you're going to put in the book, Arthur, what stood out as a humorous thing? What I found kind of funny was the real tribalism within the counties about protecting Ring, protecting Mackie, and protecting everything they did, even if sometimes on the pitch they were out of line.
Oh, massively. Massively. There is absolutely no objectivity fails sometimes. And there was I suppose with Ring it was more pronounced over time, I guess, because no more than anyone else who becomes really successful, there'll be groups who'll come to resent it and assume that he's getting preferential treatment or whatever. So Ring was particularly particularly open to that. And there was what, like, he was so revered in Cork, and particularly, I suppose, post 54 when the teams weren't doing as well, he becomes kind of more subject to that scrutiny and that kind of, because he could still win games on his own despite his own kind of ageing and whatever else. So the notion of trying to pull him down a peg or two, and you'd have the Examiner, the Echo, whatever else, they'd jumping into things like, and to be fair, at that stage, like, he'd become such a national figure. You all had your national journalists who liked particular people and didn't like other particular people as much. And they'd be jumping into gear to protect these guys at any cost. And it wasn't, like, to be fair, like, it was his protection insofar as it probably went way too far the other way with other people who, like, Tipperary loved sticking it to Ring in any way, shape or form, like in certain Tipperary papers, any sort of misstep, any loss, any whatever else, they'd take a great pleasure in doing that. And of course, they respected whatever else, but they loved it in a way that the same Tipperary media, for whatever reason, really seemed to have a fondness for Mackie.
Okay.
And there's an amazing kind of thing late in Mackie's career. I'm not sure, I forget who the match is against, but you're talking 44, 45. He wasn't far from retirement, where he was playing for Limerick still, and I think whether it was Tip they were playing or Cork, wherever they lost anyway, Limerick. But there was an amazing kind of little ode to him, almost this kind of legendary figure who was still holding on. And it's like, you know, it's like, oh, he did some good stuff. Like, he was still kind of a little bit of things that him. And they framed it in such a way where clearly they could have been cruel, but they chose the kind of more valiant, I suppose, option, and gave him a little bit of praise. And I suppose there was all that kind of tribalism, as you're saying, and they'd kind of pick and choose, and you'd have your friends and foes.
Is there a key game for each that stands out from your research you did for this book?
Oh, it's a great question. In terms of its national significance, I think the record breaker for Ring in 54, the eighth, was like nothing else. That was
against Wexford.
Yeah, that drove him to, not necessarily drove him, but that I don't know if the interest in that in a hurling game would have ever been matched. I mean, you're talking probably the Kilkenny tip five in a row type thing, but
yes,
focused entirely around one person.
Okay.
So this guy's going for the record eight, you know. There was amazing details from that, from like Pádraic O'Keefe Pádraic O'Keefe, who ran Crow Park, or secretary of the GAA, but he about how far and wide applications for tickets were coming. So this was, I presume, to a certain degree, some people could walk up, but like, you had a thing where you referenced it there, like 80 odd thousand, more than exceeds today, but more people kind of God knows how many locked out. So that, in terms of his significance, I think in terms of his play and the peak of him, as much as we can tell and go on, and everyone retrospectively has their own kind of opinions, but I think particularly from 46, after the initial four in a row they lost, when he comes back 46 and the late 40s into 50s, I think people were saying he was playing his best hurling. And that would have been him, I suppose, at what age? So late 40s. So in approaching his 30s, that kind of peak end, that there was definitely an amazing kind of thing from, I think it was Val Dorgan or someone who said, more or less like, if you could bottle it, or if I could show anyone a game to show you who Christy Ring was, this is the period here. That's where he was at his absolute zenith. For Mackie, it's harder to know. By his own estimation, 34, just getting over the line was the big one. And I think that's probably the key difference between a star from a county like Limerick and a star from a county like Cork. Just to get over the line was one, and it's like the relief. And it's like, I've done it, whatever else happens, no one can take that away from me, I've done it. But by the same token, I mean, he hits his peak. I tell you when it probably, this in 36, he's captain for the first time. And Limerick had been touring America. Now, obviously, it was off the back. They hadn't won in 35, but they'd won in 34, but they toured America at the start of 36. And it's an incredible detail when you think about it. Obviously, it took months. But they went over and won a few games and become world champions. But when they were away, the GEA, and I don't know who's put the pressure on to accommodate and whatever, the Munster Council, ever, it was agreed that it's like, they might be a bit tired. They can go straight into the Munster final in 1936. So when you think about that, how competitive it was, so they go straight into the Munster final, and that game Mackie scores something incredible. And I think by John Mackie's estimation, he said of Mick that was the day. He was like, this, nobody would have stopped him. And what's so interesting is, because I suppose these guys aren't all was natural leaders, both men captained their county to win All-Irelands. I suspect both men's captaining style might have been different so far as whatever a captain was, but what was interesting from Mackie's point of view was he really seemed to embody, I suppose, or feel whatever he felt in the responsibility that this is my team now, and I suppose I have to make sure we take them over the line. And that's what they did. They end up, they win the Munster Championship, they win the All-Ireland, already champions of the world apparently, so that's it. But his thing in 36 was when the star went up to another level again.
What do you think of Limerick and Cork now, Arthur? Because between, say, 1940, Mackie's last All-Ireland, and 2018, Limerick only won one All-Ireland, 1973, yeah. And now they've won, six, including this year, since 2018. And Cork are going through their longest famine in their history back to 2005. It's an interesting diversion based on the history and the legacies for both counties.
Well, that's it. It's a complete anomaly. Like, because it's even, we think of the lads now, the Limerick lads, like, they've far surpassed anything that Mackie team did. You know, they've blown it out of the water. So it's success on a level that no Limerick team has ever even come close to experiencing. But I think that's interesting in a way that I suppose these things can happen to varying degrees. And you'll remember, but obviously, Clare coming from North win two All-Irelands in the 90s, you know. It's an incredible, they can happen, and you have luck in different things of how many you amass, but like there's an element to that that's understandable, you can explain that. But I think what's never really happened is it's gone the other way. Kilkenny, Tipperary, Cork account for about, a last check, it's about two-thirds of the All-Irelands ever won. They have them shared between them, and it's Kilkenny, obviously Cork are a little bit ahead of Tipperary, but none of them ever went too long without winning. So for a 20-year gap to emerge it's unthinkable, because it's never happened. It's never happened. It's never even come close to happening. And there's that great Paddy Barry line, the coach that, you know, whatever, Cork hurlers are like mushrooms. You know, they come up overnight. It's like, it's just an incredible thing that you assume Cork will come and win in All-Ireland. And we've just never had a county that is so ingrained in winning. And I often find that very interesting when you go back, because you, even from Christy Ring, throughout his childhood, I'm not sure exact number, but Cork won two or three or four All-Irelands during his childhood. It was something he was aware of, obviously, from a young age. This is a count, we win All-Irelands. Same way with a Kerry footballer, Kilkenny hurler, whatever it is. It's so interesting now to think what will happen going forward for all those guys now who grow up in Cork, that haven't seen the county win. Like, you think anyone, like, it's anyone who was born from 2000 on probably doesn't really have any recollection of them winning in All-Ireland. And those boys are all like 25, 26 now. It's a very, it'll be interesting. Maybe they get it over the line. Maybe it's all over and that's it and they kind of kick back into gear. But it's very interesting how quickly it can unravel and whether that has any sort of residual effect. Because I imagine it's a very tough thing to deal with. There's a great story I remember from before talking to Eamon Cregan, who was obviously part of the 1973 Limerick team. And he said something about hearing Mick Mackey, and I'm not sure was it first-hand, second-hand, but about a thing saying that's more or less a weight off the shoulders now. It's like, at least we're not the last team. You know what I mean? Sort of the 40th, 73 broken. And I know he particularly, and a lot of that team in 73, felt it even more so when Limerick finally broke through in 18. It's like, thank God people can stop talking to us now as the last. It's like, that's fine. It's an isolation. So it'll be interesting with time how that 05 Cork team comes to look in hindsight. Like, it's, you know, the last Cork team to win in All-Ireland is not really something that's ever kind of been uttered before.
No, no.
You know, you never think about it.
What would the legacy of Mick Mackey and Christy Ring be? Obviously, there's a huge legacy within them that you'd write the book in the first place, Arthur. But yeah, what is it? What's it going to be? Because you learned, obviously, a lot more about these two people than you would have known 2-3 years ago.
Well, it's funny because absolutely. I think there's an interesting thing with Ring, because Cork is not at all shy of hurlers that you could call, like, that would be of immense standard, immense standing in any county. And somehow he stands amongst all, above all them, even. And I'm not sure if, say, Kilkenny, who have, like, obviously a commensurate number of All-Irelands, have that one figure who stands above everyone conclusively in the way Ring does. So I suspect with Ring, the legacy retains, particularly in Cork, of just a level of excellence that exemplifies the ability that Cork will always produce talented hurlers, we assume. But to reach that next level, like, this is how this guy worked. This is the effort he put in. This guy, like, the guy played inter-county hurling for over 2 decades. It's not like he wasn't playing. I know people kind of look back now and think, well, yeah, the championships were shorter. It's like, that's grand. Look at the number of club games, the number of exhibitions, the number of things. They were playing all the time. And maybe it didn't take the same toll on your body, but by the same token, there wasn't sports science to the same degree. 20-odd years of inter-county hurling is 20-odd years of inter-county hurling. There's no way that that's not easy or that that's hard. That's not hard on the body. Like, so I think there's a grit and determination to him paired with the excellence that kind of exemplifies everything at Cork hurler would imagine their stars to be. With Mackey, it's a little bit different because up until 2018, he exemplified something that I don't think many Limerick fans would necessarily have thought was possible to regain. It'll be very interesting at the passage of time, where he's obviously going to be an incredibly important figure in Limerick GA history always. And you have the Mackey stand there, whatever else thing, he'll always be there, bet into it. But it is interesting in time that there's players now who have emerged, who have surpassed what he has done. And he almost, like, you look at thinking Man United's not a bad example of it, where I suppose there's a certain time where it would have been unconscionable to think that, say, Matt Busby could be outdone in what
best
he
best law in Charlton.
Yeah.
And then you've Ferguson. And
you just think, like, and maybe, who knows, they were closer in time, so maybe it's a lesser thing. But it'll be very interesting over time how Mackey is remembered, just by virtue of the fact that such an amazing team now is going to redefine what Limerick hurling is remembered as. And hopefully, I suppose, books like this, hopefully that kind of manages to keep it alive a little bit, because his importance to Limerick is really unmatched in terms of, even though those boys were celebrated who came through in 18 for the fact that they almost didn't pay history any heed, they were still replaying history by doing the very thing that Mackey and his team did 70 or whatever years earlier. That was exactly what they were doing, not paying history any heed and redefining what Limerick hurling could be.
I think one of the things I took out of the book, just to finish, Arthur, is that Ireland was a young nation. We obviously had Paddy Callaghan and Bob Tisdall in LA and that kind of thing, but we needed stars like Mackey and Ring. Ireland as a young country needed these stars.
I think so, and I think it embodied a sort of Irish exceptionalism that you need. You
Mick almost O'Connell in football.
Exactly. You have to trick yourself almost, because there's obviously, like, there's a great scene in 36 where they win the All-Ireland, Limerick win the All-Ireland, and there's a big, massive homecoming for them in the Savoy Cinema in Limerick, which had been built and was one of loads of cinemas across the city. Cinema was huge. But it was a really incredible thing, and I think it was from when that cinema opened the previous year. All the donations were given to the poor of Limerick. It was like 100 and something pounds were given to the poor of Limerick. And you kind of dig in and you like, there was incredible sort of prosperity and progress and everything else allied with that level of poverty and struggle that was still there. So these boys, I suppose, showed a degree of what you could be. And you don't want to overstate it and say that it helped, you know, nothing like Italia 90 or whatever started the Celtic Tiger. Like, it's not that kind of thing. Like, but it is a, I suppose there was a brightness to them and a hope to them that was intoxicating. That's why people came, you know. In 1961 in Limerick, there was a Munster final between Cork and Tipperary. Ring was 41 or whatever, 40-41. And 60-odd thousand documented came in the gate in the Gaelic grounds. Still the record for a Munster final. Like, these boys had an effect on people that was just, it's very hard to pin down.
Eamon Dunn in touch on WhatsApp 0879 180 180. My dad is one of the kids behind Ring and Mackie in the picture. He's spoken about the incident several times. So
there you go.
Thank you for your contribution, Eamon. And thank you, Arthur, James and Dee, for coming in.
That's my pleasure.
This Saturday on Off the Ball, I would urge lovers of hurling and sports fans in general to buy this great book, Mackie and Ring, a fascinating and interesting read. All I can say, Arthur, is congratulations on a fine job you've done here, sir. And we wish you the very best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much, John. Appreciate it.
Okay, Arthur James O'Dea in studio. Buy the book. Simple as that, folks. Mackie and Ring.
Off the Ball. GAA.
This is a free Off the Ball podcast. For access to the best in sporting analysis from the likes of Brian O'Driscoll, Andy Dunn, Kevin Kilbane, Dion Fanning, Tommy Walsh, Darren O'Sullivan and lots more, become an Off the Ball member today.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.